the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast is just two guys and maybe a guest or two discussing Bitcoin, Bitcoin equities, and the related macroeconomic space. It's not meant to be financial advice, so please, if you're doing any investing after listening to our program, do your own research, do your own due diligence, and understand that any money you invest can be lost. The show is meant for entertainment purposes only, and we hope you enjoy the program. Unknown how much of that video anyone saw, but anyway, friends and enemies, welcome to the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast. Thanks for coming on the CBP Media Network. My name is Joey, and in the other panel, my co-host Len. Buddy, I noticed your block clock there misfiring. What's going on?
Wow, I didn't even notice that. I don't know what's going on. I'll have to do something to rectify that. I don't know. Maybe I can't even guess. Everything's working.
Should we cut the stream? Want to cut it and start again for the sake of appearances? Yeah.
Give me 5 minutes. Yeah. No. That's pretty messed up. I just noticed that. There you go. So obviously, I'm not looking in the background of my screen for most of the day. It doesn't really matter. Anyway. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, that's it, man. So that's the show. Thank you for coming in. hope you all enjoyed it, and it's going to be a great riff next week. Thank you very much.
Let's before we get into the ads, let's talk a bit about some of the stuff that's been going on the network, and also some of the stuff that you and me have done and are doing in the next couple of days. So this is the first flagship we've done since we started the Bear Cave, which is on the main feed. We did two episodes, one with Doomberg, one with Mike Green. Very thankful to them for their time. We have one more guest in the pipeline for that at the moment. And we're going to release those episodes as often as we can. Hey, Len, I don't want to make any guarantees about the frequency, but as often as we can and as often as good guests are available and willing to come on the program and talk with us. I don't want to cheapen the content there and the quality of the show, because I think the content was really good the first two episodes. And I know tonight in the chat, we may get some commentary that goes the other way, but I'm happy to take that and embrace it. I think, All Caps was pretty vocal that night and on Twitter as well. But we spoke a little bit on Twitter the next day or the day after. And, I think we all agree that if we're not hearing this stuff and dealing with this stuff as far as criticisms go, we're doing ourselves a disservice as the podcast, first of all. And I think as well the ecosystem, the Bitcoin ecosystem. So we did those two last week. Also last week, we were on the Your Life, Your Term show on Thursday afternoon.
Oh, I forgot to wear the shirt today. They gave us a the latest logo. Darn it.
So we were there for a bit. Yeah, too bad. Tom and Nick were very very generous with their time to have us on. We always appreciate the invite. Talking to them is always a good time. We share a lot of things in common, and they have a different perspective on certain things thanks to their background in real estate and business. And so we did that. That should release sometime this week, I think. I'm not sure when. And then this Friday, yours truly will be on Why Are We Bullish? So yeah, looking forward to that. I haven't been on Ben's show in a while. Len actually was on, I think, about a month and a half ago, right?
Something like that. Yeah. So who's the your running mates on that one? You know,
I don't know yet. I haven't looked at my Twitter DMs. I've been busy, like I was telling you before the show, but I'm gonna have a look. I don't know, maybe after the show, or if Ben sends it to me tomorrow. I don't know when does he usually tell people? He usually tells people at the beginning of the week, right?
Something like that. Yeah, you would have got something. And you know what, to be honest, I think Guy Swan was with me, but I can't remember who else. And it's been so long ago. That's how long it's been since I've been on Ben's show. Ben, I'm ready to go back on whenever you want. I've been on too many times. I think it's time to give it that opportunity to somebody else. But I'm always willing to go back if he needs it. But
yeah.
I'm curious to see what's going on with you.
He's a very gracious host. He's meant a lot to the growth of this show for sure when we were a lot smaller. So we're always happy to do what we can to support him. And I think that's it for housekeeping, Len. Is there anything else you want to say before we get into the sponsors?
Well, we're still giving away sats, donating sats, anything that's been donated to us through Fountain or Podcasting 2.0. It's value for value, whatever you want to call it. They're all being directed automatically to Bitcoin Ekasi, and that's they're trying to build a Bitcoin community in South Africa. And I don't know exactly how many sats are being sent to us, because again, it's just automatically being redirected to Bitcoin Ekasi. But I think it's a decent amount, considering if you go look at the list of hot shows on Fountain based on how many Satoshis are being donated, we're climbing up the ranks. Right now, we're sitting at 23, last I checked, and we're ahead of other shows. Like, I see Ben is on there, BTC Sessions is on there. I see Bitcoin Media. There's a whole bunch of others we're ahead of, which is interesting that we're ahead of them. Simply Bitcoin, we're ahead of that show. So that's fantastic stuff. So keep on sending us sats, and there's going to be redirected to Bitcoin at Cassie. It's a good cause. So they're not going to somewhere that it's just going to be sitting in somebody's pocket. They're trying to build a Bitcoin community in South Africa. So we highly recommend continuing to give us some Satoshis for our efforts, and it goes to somewhere else. So this is all good.
That's right.
Yeah. Also, I have a few Fountain comments that I'd like to bring up, some boots. And I'll just bring up a few generic ones here. I see Nikki Gag saying, "You guys are amazing. Since nobody in my entourage knows or ever wants to know, to talk about Bitcoin, you are my only go-to source for Bitcoin. Thank you." Joy's Achilles also sent a couple of Fountain boosts, but I'm not going to read them because they're still live a little bit out of left field here. I will not even go there. Some very enlightening stuff. Great podcast. Love the show information and the guests. Good job, fellas. That's from Bobo Tummy. Zika Boy writes, "Fuck Craig Wrong and fake Toshi cunt." This is not from us. This is from lots of great comments. Keep them coming in. They're funny shit, and I love reading them. So, yeah, there's so many more too. I could just keep going on and on, but lots to talk about today.
We're at the sponsor now. Let's do the sponsors. Before I say that, chat is humming today. So hello to everyone who's there. Yochi, Connor, Narwhal, Bleak, RFR always here. Rox is here tonight. Rod, love to see you, buddy. Boomer's here. Wedge, haven't seen you talking about chips in a while there, Danny boy. Tim and Nancy Danter, Dab is here. Chooch, it's a good night for some Bitcoin economic talk. We got a lot to talk about tonight, but before we start, you want to say something else? Go ahead.
Isn't there a giveaway we're doing today too?
Mentioned it on Twitter before the show started. Mm-hmm. I told everyone last week I was going to schedule a tweet for during the show, and I didn't. So if you see me looking away from the screen for any prolonged period of time, that could be what I'm doing. So anyway, this show, as with all shows, brought to you by ShakePay, the easiest place for Canadians to buy and never sell their Bitcoin. They got a bunch of stuff going on. First of all, sign up with our promo code CBP. You get 30 bones on your first $100 buy, which is pretty good. Not bad. 30% return. Use it to buy gas. Use it to buy ketchup chips. Use it to buy more Bitcoin, whatever you want. But it's your money once you spend a hundo. Also, they got shaking sats. If you use a promo code to sign up, you shake your phone every day, and they'll funnel you a little bit of Bitcoin up to 1,000 sats after day 365. So make sure when you're shaking something else that I know you guys are shaking, you're shaking your phone as well. They also have the Sats Back card line. You spend off your CAD balance and get Satoshis returned to you. 2% on the first 5,000, 1% on every dollar after that. They have Shake Paid. So if you spend off your CAD balance as well, on top of the Sats Back, you may even get the whole thing comp and Satoshis 100% of the purchase price back to you in Sats. And finally, Len, the important one for tonight, the squads, Shake Squads, you and four friends. Seems like one of those old concert commercials Much Music used to run. You and four friends can win tickets to the Budweiser stage. Anyway, you and four friends can join up on a squad. And what happens is you each spend a little bit of money. You buy a bag of milk, or you buy a bag of chips, or you buy some other seed oil-laden product at the corner store. And everyone in your team gets 42 Satoshis. Tonight, we're going to run a contest to see who has the most Shake Squad sats stacked up all time. So I'm going to, like I said, put out a tweet some point tonight. I'm going to mention it on the show that I'm putting it out. And for 10 minutes, we're going to let teams post photos of their shaking squad sat totals. And if there's any discrepancies, if there's any issues, I'm going right to Carlo. I'm going right to ShakePay. I'm saying, hey, look, you got to verify this for me, because I don't want to send shirts to the wrong people. We are going to ask you for your mailing address. Okay. So you have to at least like send me docs here. Whether you trust us or not, I don't know, or a PO box, or if you want to, you know, I'll leave it under the park bench or something in Hamilton. You can come pick it up. I'll tape it to the bench. And that's, you know, another way you can get it. But anyway, yeah, those are all things Shake Bay. No, it won't be gone. No one's going to take them. That's all Shake Bay's got going on, Len. Who's the other sponsor? What do they got going on?
We have Ledin. And if you open up an account with our referral code below, and if you fund your account with 150,000 Satoshis or 75 USDC and keep it under platform for at least 15 consecutive days, then they're going to gift you 10 USDC. 10 USDC is going to be added to your account, no questions asked. And also, if you have a large stack of Bitcoin, because who doesn't these days, given the price of Bitcoin, and you don't want to sell it because you have and you have some bills to pay, don't sell it. Just go to Ledin and borrow against your Bitcoin. 50% loan to value, they'll give you the money and you're good to go. Also, if you think the price of Bitcoin is going up, I always do, but then again, I'm eternally bullish over here. B2X, where you could double up your Bitcoin stack. Ledin has that nice feature. You just use B2X. Well, voila, now you have doubled up your Bitcoin stack. And pull out once the price of Bitcoin gets up high enough, because when you do that, then you have gamed the system and now you have more Bitcoin simply by timing the market and using Ledin's B2X. And the last thing they have is Bitcoin-backed mortgages. This is an industry first, but of course, it's not available in every jurisdiction. So please check their website where that is being offered. And since you're there, check to see what are the interest for the savings and borrowing rates. They change on a month-to-month basis, and we'll be talking about that later in the show, Joey. So that's it for Ledin in terms of their read. Do we have the price of Bitcoin handy?
I know you don't. $20,150 US.
Well, I have it in Canadian, always ready. $26,196. Maybe not in American, but I have it in US dollars right here. Oh, sorry,
Canadian. Love it, buddy.
So I'm good to go. Anything else you want to scratch off the list here of things to do, or just go right at it? Because
one thing. I wrote it in the chat, but I'm not going to tweet out from my account. I'm working on tweeting out show stuff from the show account predominantly, and then you know there might be occasional stuff from my account or Lens account, but generally show stuff is going to go from the show account, including tonight's contest tweet. So one more time, you comment under the tweet, reply to the tweet, and just say, this is my Shake Squad team. This is my Shake tag, and put a picture up of the number of sats you guys have earned. All right. Easy peasy lemon squeezy. Len, let's get into the A block, buddy. See what I did there? I saw you drinking your water. I just dragged out a few syllables for you and now you're good to go.
I am, but I'm going to have to ask for your forgiveness here, because this is going to be a lengthy rant on my part, because the economy, so much is going on in that realm. So it's now being reported that the U.S. bond market is projecting to have a stellar year. Not sure if you've been paying attention to this, Joey, and they're on pace for the worst year in history, with a loss of 10% being recorded. And I'm wondering how much this has to do with the Federal Reserve slowing down the purchasing of bonds, but maybe the Bank of Japan could step up their game and scoop up a higher percentage of U.S. assets. They're always out there looking to buy a little bit more U.S. stuff. As for Bloomberg, they were reporting that locally in the U.S., while cities and states, they have backed away from selling bonds themselves as a way to cover pension obligations. And they are stopping this practice. Why? Well, due to rising borrowing costs. And if this trend continues, how will these cities and states fund their pension programs? Will taxation and user fees be enough to cover everything? Probably not, in my honest opinion. So likely, if that's the case, this is unsustainable and the unfunded pension gap will continue to widen. And to help illustrate this a little bit further, U.S. municipalities, they have experienced a drop in 70% in bond sales since last year. It's only $2.8 billion were sold off this year. So now you know how much percentage-wise and in totality they sold. So you could connect the dots here. So the civil servants' pension, wrecked. And this past week, the two-year treasuries, they climbed to 3.45%. And this is the highest since November 2007. And telling signs of where the demand is and where the lack of demand is. Data from the Fed. And we have now the deepest 2-10s yield curve inversion over the last 20 years. And this is even deeper than in 2008. Adios to short-term borrowing and long-term lending. Something is going to have to break in the next 12 months. It always does once you get to this point into 2-10s. More data supporting we are trending in the wrong direction. And if you do an adjustment for inflation, retail sales in e-commerce has fallen 2% year over year. And I'm sure some of you are saying, well, it's only 2%. It's a very small number. Well, this only happened once in the past 20 years, and that was in 2008, 2009 recession. So again, shades of 2008, 2009. Zombie companies, something we talk about infrequently on the show. Joey, do you know of any zombie companies off the top of your head?
Yeah, Celsius.
More than that. Come on.
Yeah, BlockFi. Who else? Who else is a zombie company?
Air Canada.
AC is a great one. That's a snipe. Yeah.
WestJet. So these are companies that require bailouts to operate, and they're dependent on creditors to lend them money because they're on life support. Well, from StansberryResearch.com, we now have a record amount of zombie companies in the U.S. Now, it's 25% of all companies fall within this category. Incredible number. The previous record, 17%, set in 2001. So we obliterated that record. But one constant we've been hearing all along, supply chain this, supply chain that. And one way to not correct this is to watch one of the largest U.S. freight companies cut their staff. And this is exactly what's happening with U.S. Express. And they have announced they're going to shrink their workforce by 10%. What they deem to be a cost-cutting plan also involves pulling back on capital expenditures. Also of note, their capital cost, Joey, 25% year over year.
There's nothing wrong with that, Len. Sir, that's not problematic at all, sir. Sustainable is the word that comes to mind.
I like that. Okay, let's transition to student loans. I know we talked about this on the last week's Nooner, and I don't want to rehash too much on this.
One thing I should have said, last week I also went on Green Candle Investments show, and we talked about student loans as well. So check that out. Brandon's a good friend of ours. Sorry, continue, please, sir.
It's available on YouTube. And wherever you listen.
And wherever, podcast and YouTube. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, sorry. Sure. That's a terrible interruption from me, but I forgot.
No. This is more than worthy interruption. I'm good with that. So on the topic of that, I mean, again, we talked about it, but the freeze is still on for the repayments of the loans. No, this is not something that's new. Plus, we are now getting numbers, and we could digest it now. How much is it going to cost? So from Penn Wharton, they estimate the one-time maximum debt forgiveness of $10,000 per borrower would cost roughly $300 billion if the relief is limited to those with incomes less than $125,000. I didn't think this is true, but I did the math. There's 30 million people, multiply it by 10,000. You got that number? I was blown away at that. Then this cost will increase to $330 billion if the program is continued over a decade. Nationalizing student loans, love it. And we hear all this talk about energy prices in Europe. And I'll be brief on this because I'll skip this altogether because I'm going to talk this later on. But in the U.S., we have household electricity charges. They're up 15% from last summer. That's a sizable jump. USA Today is reporting that 20 million U.S. households, think about this, Joey, 20 million U.S. households are behind on paying their utility bills. There has been a jump of 40% of the number of customers being shut off from services. With winter looming, people better be prepared for the worst case for those living in colder climates. And another interesting stat, home flipping in the U.S. is, or actually was, a big thing. Axios was reporting that 1 in 10 U.S. homes sold in the first quarter of 2022 was due to flipping. This means that it was bought and sold within a year at arm's length buyer. This is the highest since 2000. I don't know what to make of this, but a lot of homes are just being bought up and sold. Maybe it's a lot of speculation of people buying in. Maybe it's renovation, bringing in dirty money, selling it as a way of laundering the money. I don't know, but this is what's being done. And, well, rent, we could talk about that. Skyrocketing everywhere. But San Francisco, Joey. I wonder why. Do you know anything with rent? What a hole that's turning out to be, unfortunately. It was a beautiful city at one time. And as previously mentioned in our show, the median rent of U.S. top 2,000 a month, and this happened back in June, but the increases, there's no sign of stopping. And this is from Yahoo. Those rising rents mean that households representing a total of 8.5 million people, not a small number, were behind on their rent at the end of August, according to Census Bureau figures. And 3.8 million of those renters say they are somewhat or very likely to be evicted in the next 2 months. 3.8 million people, Joey, that's twice the size of Toronto.
Big number. Toronto has on the sign anyway, 3 point something million population. So the entire city of Toronto on the street, basically.
So where are they going to go, Joey? Well, I got
that bridge that I saw.
I got a story from you, because now let's move from the sad to the insane. I know
exactly.
So LA voters, they're going to go to the polls in 2024 and they're going to vote on a proposal for hotels to give up vacant rooms to homeless individuals. Also, all these people that are going to be evicted, all they have to do is move to LA, deal with it for the next 2 years. This proposal gets passed, they're good to go. So with this happens, will hotels be compensated at full rates? Probably not. Will people opt out for staying in these hotels? Probably. And I have a feeling there's going to be a large number of hotels closing up shop once the proposal is enacted. But even with all this, the U.S. is still showing their charitable signs. And I'm not trying to make light of this situation here, but in the Ukraine, what's going on? Well, the U.S., they just announced they're going to loan or give out $3 billion for arm packages for Ukraine. And this is really a small drop in the bucket, considering $30 trillion in total U.S. debt. But the question remains by some people where this money could be better spent. And there are some people that, even with all this, they do have a lot of money. In fact, Lamborghini, they announced that they sold out their fleet until 2024, Joey. So no Lambo for you, unfortunately, unless you want to wait it out. So apparently there's a high demand for high-end cars. And abroad, things are not looking good. I said I was going to talk about Europe, so here we are. So people in Europe, they're getting some sage advice on how to save money moving forward. In fact, you could shower elsewhere. You could charge up your phones at work. You could use the office coffee machines to make coffee. But these guys, they're missing the obvious. This was on Reddit, I think it was. This was posted. Some of the obvious things. You could bring your laundry into work if there's a washing machine. You could bring your dishes in if there's a dishwasher there. You could steal gas from your coworkers. Or better yet, your boss. These are some really good ways that you could save money that we're bringing forth. In fact, this is the money-saving advice people come here to see. So please tune into the CBP Stretch Your Money show, premiering this fall. And for those watching energy prices in Europe, people are obviously now starting to feel the pinch. This is from Austria, Wien Energie. Now, my apologies, my Austrian is difficult at best. They are the largest energy supplier. They're now insolvent. They require 1.7 billion euros to remain liquid, according to local media. Not a small number for.
And they got the injection too. They got the injection.
Oh, they did. Okay, so
yeah,
from
they got it.
Do you know
from the Austrian government? They gave them all the money. It was announced, I think, not even 4 or 5 hours ago.
But where did that money come from? Is it they're taking it, robbing it from Peter to pay Paul, or is it
from the Austrian taxpayer? Wow.
See, I don't know what the hell's going on. But anyways, businesses in Europe, they're reporting massive energy costs, and some are 10x higher than before. And it may be time to stock up on AA batteries, start selling them to Europeans at a profit again. This is going to be laid out in further detail in the CBP Stretch Your Money program show that's coming out later this year. And the higher energy costs, they're causing businesses to start closing up shop because it's impossible to pass on these higher costs to consumers because, of course, they can't pay it. They'll just go somewhere else. An example of the higher energy costs that are being experienced. Next year, Germany, their electricity bill as a country is expected to be 500 billion euros. That's 13% of their GDP. It used to be only 1%. So that's a massive jump, 13x. So less will be spent on social programs, as money is going to be used to pay for electricity. Either, what are they going to do for this? Are they going to accumulate more debt or print money? I don't know. Even Volkswagen came out, there was a report saying that they're going to start hoarding windshields. Breweries are going to start hoarding empty bottles because apparently there's a glass shortage coming up and they're preparing for the worst. Speaking of shortages, France, President Emmanuel Macron, well, he was talking to French citizens saying that we're now entering into a new phase where it's going to be the, quote, end of abundance, end quote, except for bug sandwiches. I'm pretty sure this is going to be a huge supply.
Did you see the picture or the video clip of Macron giving that speech about the end?
I saw the video.
It's the doors behind him are gold. Ornate. Like, are you kidding me? There's gold accents on the doors. This guy's telling you that it's the end of the abundance era.
So I love that the setting is he could have done it in front of a homeless shelter, maybe in LA. That would have been probably a better setting, but anyways, that's just me thinking off the top of my so anyways, President of the European Commission came out, the EU, they're preparing for a power market emergency intervention, price control in the power market. Joey, how I don't understand this, but please indulge me. Like, I'm done here with my rant, but I'm curious, how does price control work without obliterating the currency you're working in? Just go ahead and indulge me and then go nuts.
It does. It doesn't. And don't forget that price control from like the perspective of an American or a Canadian or anyone with half a brain observing this disaster unfold overseas. It's not just one country that's calling for this. There's a bunch of countries calling for this. They're going to take Eurozone level action or try to on the price of energy. And the reason that I named the episode today Whistling Dixie, DXY, is because the dollar is fucking flying. Even as the U.S. is doing everything they can to just to knock down the value of the dollar through monetary policy, through the printing, through rate, like raising rates, everything. It's the only thing dropping faster in terms of actual value is the euro, the yuan, and the yen. They're all doing it faster. Every single one of them is doing it faster. And so people are fleeing to the dollar as the sort of safe haven asset. It is bananas how crazy this has gone. And you know, I got some stuff here that I wrote down this morning, and we can talk a bit more about the stuff you were talking about, because I think this is an important conversation. There's a lot to say. Bloomberg has a report in terms of your dollar figure there about the $300 billion in total debt forgiveness, right? Mm-hmm. So let's start with one thing here. Do you know how many households approximately in the United States are going to get that relief?
I'm thinking 30 million.
30 million people.
Oh, my bad.
Yeah, about 8 million households. It's about 8 million households.
Multiples.
Yeah, so really not that many people. Now, here's a better one. Do you know what the White House said the total revenue increase for the Fed would be because of the Inflation Reduction Act?
No. I'd love to hear how much.
$300 billion.
Oh, so it's going to wash it.
They gave it to 8 million households with the snap of a finger. By the way, a lot of commentary around, you know, how can Biden do this? It's unconstitutional, blah, blah, blah. I think some people have realized this already, but certainly in the next week or two, it's going to become a huge story that the only reason you can do this as a president with an executive order is because he's in a state of emergency, which was just extended vis-a-vis the COVID emergency until December. So, I mean, you look at these things together and you can't help but think this is a bit, you know, treacherous in terms of, I'm going to really try and pick my words carefully here. The man is buying votes. Okay, there's no doubt. And there's a couple of things I could point to show this. I was listening to All In yesterday, and David Sacks, notorious Republican, very smart guy, says Democratic thinker Roy Teixeira points out in a recent Bloomberg piece that white college grads are plus 12 points favorable to Democratic politicians. Do you know what Republican non-grad whites are, working class, quote unquote, Republicans are they're plus 25. So the gap is huge. And so in order to close that gap for an election that's coming up, probably this is what you have to do. You have to give these people about $10,000 or $20,000 each to vote for you. Right. And the question is that going to get them out to the polls? I don't know. I really have no idea. Interesting to talk about this all the same. I would also say from like the student loan thing, this doesn't really solve the problem. I think we've talked about this on the show before. We're not the only people that have talked about this. This is like pretty commonly understood. It doesn't solve the core issue. The core issue is what? The core issue is students are told early on in their academic careers, high school, generally speaking, grade 9, you know, you're 13 or 14 years old, you got to go to university, got to go to college. Okay, so what do? You try and find yourself a stream that will allow you to enter into these post-secondary institutions. For some people, it's STEM, right? Whether it's engineering, math, whatever the case is. But for others, then, it's not that easy. And sometimes you wind up with people in sociology, psychology, things like that. There may be paths to profitable careers there or ways to enjoy your life on those careers and make money on those careers. But they're a lot more narrow than the STEM fields. And then because of the way that government is subsidizing these programs, what we've seen is universities expanding their offerings, quote unquote offerings, to make sure that all Americans can go to school, all Americans can get a post-secondary education. And we see that governments are interested in this statistic because they consistently tout how many of their population, you know, by percentage, are higher education, finishers, let's say, higher education eligible or higher education, involved in higher education somehow, some way. So we know this metric is important to first world governments, specifically in the United States in this case. This is not good. This is not good because what we've done here is remove the economic calculation for students. They don't have to think at all about what the income earning potential is in this job or this educational field or this academic field. Worse, I keep on hearing people say that, well, kids don't really know what they want to do and they don't really know whether or not their job is going to make money. It's hard to predict 10 years out, you know, in a job market at 17 or 18. Okay, but what about 20? If you spent 2 years in a school, you know, certainly you would be able to see whether or not you thought there was going to be jobs available to you. Presumably, I know in my case, perhaps in yours as well, you know, I was thinking about what job I was going to get with my poli sci degree. And I ended up, you know, thinking about other career paths and whatnot and ended up in the job I have now after some debate and, you know, pinballing around after university and things of that nature. This is the case for many people, but to say that you can't make that calculation, you can't make that observation at 20 or 21 years old, I think is just ridiculous. That's one thing. I'd also say, Len, that the people who are, you know, working to pay that bill now that the government has kind of put out here, this $300 billion and, you know, and associated costs with administering these things and whatnot, the people who are receiving that money aren't paying the tax bill, because if they were significant tax revenue sources, they wouldn't need the bailout. They'd be ahead of the $125,000 or $250,000 threshold for a family and wouldn't have received the money in the first place. Instead, what you're going to see is people who are angry they didn't get help, successful in their careers, and part of a broader tax base, now also tasked with paying for the barista's underwater basket weaving degree to the tune of, you know, whatever it is, $1,000 a year or something like that. I can't remember exactly the numbers I've seen, but it's not nothing. Why don't we also add here, since you didn't talk about it, it's kind of flying under the radar. You know now that as part of that relief bill, there's a cap on how much of your salary can go to your college loan repayment per month. Do you know what the cap is?
I couldn't even have a clue. And I don't know, why would they even institute this?
Because it's supporting the same, you know, sort of incompetent barista that made a bad decision and continues to make bad decisions, presumably. It's 5%. So you're never, you know, you may not have to pay every month that number that really puts you in dire straits. But by the same token, what does it mean if the cap is 5% and you're only paying that minimum? You're never going to get out from under that loan. You're never going to get out from under the loan. And as soon as interest payments resume after this latest moratorium on payments and responsibility, which is really what we should be calling it, a moratorium on responsibility. What are we talking about here? These people are no better off. And I'll just add one thing. Universities and colleges should have to pay for this bailout. They should have to. I've heard a couple people say this. The All In guy said it. I agree with it. I've been thinking about what universities and colleges have been contributing to in this country and next door and God knows how many other places, whether it's housing crises, whether it's uneducated populations, whether it's, you know, brainwashing and sort of political indoctrination in the post-secondary realm, whether it's this sort of house of cards around academic peer review at that level, you name it. The contributions are very few and far between as far as positive outcomes in the last 15 or 20 years. I don't think anyone would argue with that. But what we do see from these institutions is that they have more money than God, okay? The hedge funds make a ton of money, of course, but at least they're taking some risks. What's the Harvard Endowment doing in terms of risk exactly that should be netting them that 50, 60, 70 billion war chest that they have? Any care to comment on that or no?
No, it's sitting right now a little bit over $50 billion, which is more than companies like Meta/Facebook have on their balance sheet. So I have no idea what they're doing with that to contribute to society, but that's a fucking lot of money.
It's a lot of money, man.
Order of what Apple holds, maybe a six, whatever it is. It's a very decent fraction of what Apple holds, and they have a massive amount of cash sitting around. Why Harvard?
And they're with their hands out looking for these subsidies to bring more students in, expanding the offerings program-wise, expanding the things that are available, pretending that the degrees all have value. They know it's bullshit. They know it's bullshit. They should have to pay for some of this damage as far as the damage to the treasury and the balance sheet in America. I don't have anything else to say about that. I don't know. Do you have Jackson Hole on the docket tonight?
Okay. Yeah,
I'm done with that topic. If you want to close it up, it's all yours.
Okay, I want to ask you, did you ever read the Fiat Standard from SAFE?
I have it. I haven't read it yet.
So in it, it explains in very detailed language what happens when all other currencies are failing, which is experiencing what we're experiencing now, is there's going to be a flight to the hardest currency out there, which is going to be the US dollar. So it's playing out exactly the way he pointed it out. But this is even though the US dollar is the one that's doing the best right now, you're basically comparing one shitcoin to another.
This is dollar milkshake theory, right? I'm pretty sure that's dollar milkshake theory, what you're describing and what we described earlier. Flight to the US dollar and a spike in US dollar value right before it craters.
It's not right before it craters. It's just that it's the hardest currency out there. Every other currency is a derivative of the US dollar, and it's priced in accordance to the US dollar. So because you have the petrodollar, for instance, so there's a huge demand right now and has been for quite some time for the US dollar. A lot of countries have scrapped their own currency in favor of the US dollar too. So there's lots of demand for it. So that's the last one that's going to stand. And as all other ones continue to fail, the US dollar is going to be the last one to be standing, right, but ultimately will capitulate because it ultimately is a shitcoin. So you're really comparing a shitcoin versus another shitcoin in a basket of shitcoins. Sure, your Doge might be going up in comparison to SHIB and Atom and all this other shit, but it's still a shitcoin. If you compare it ultimately against assets, be it hard, consumable, desirable assets, fuck even services, it's getting obliterated. So it may be doing well against a basket of its peers, which is fine, but in against where you could actually deem the value of something, because the valuation of something is really not in comparison to its other shitcoin peers. It's in comparison to assets. And again, you could use consumables, you could use hard, you could use desirable, whatever you want. They're all shooting up like crazy. And that's in comparison to the US dollar. But so that's that.
Assets and San Franciscan hotel residents shooting up like crazy. Anyway.
No, LA residents, hotel residents.
San Francisco, San Fran.
It's LA is doing the proposal. San Francisco, their rent is going down in comparison to the rest of the market. New York, Charlotte, Nashville, everywhere else going up. San Francisco, for whatever reason, is going down. Well, not for whatever reason. I think we understand why.
You know what, Len? We should pitch to. I know that Bob Saget's passed away. RIP. One of the better comedians of all time. But we should pitch a new era Full House in modern day San Francisco, where like Uncle Jesse is, maybe secretly moving fentanyl at the border or something like that. He's like working the port, bringing in tons of illegal drugs. I don't know if that would sell, but I feel like HBO's programming has kind of slipped last couple of years. Maybe they could take that on. What do you think?
How about Netflix? Netflix needs something for it.
Oh, they're dying for content over there. You're right. Let's pitch it to them. They'll probably, Len, we could probably get $1 billion for that. I bet me and you. They're giving money away over there.
What could you buy with $1 billion these days? I don't want to just fill up my gas tank. I want a little bit more than that. Anyways, let's talk about Jackson Hole. What's going on? I'll try to be brief then, since you're not going to go on. No house like that. So the Jackson Hole, the meetings took place and gave us a lot to talk about. And inflation really was the topic of the day. And the question is, has it peaked when will it come down? We're expecting this year from the Fed another three rate hikes, probably 50, 75 basis points in September.
September, November, and December, right? Okay.
Correct. And they're trying to achieve an end year goal of 3.5 to 3.75%. That's what they're saying. I'm not sure if this is what they're trying to achieve or something even higher than that. But considering 3.5 to 3.75%, it's a massive jump from where they started this year. They were at 0.25%. So that's pretty good, pretty big. And so what's in store for businesses and individuals moving forwards? Not Lambos for all. No way. Because they're sold out until 2024. How about French wine? Nah, abundance is done, according to Macron. Jerome Powell is predicting something far more rational for all of us. He predicts pain. Pain, man, pain. His skills with the Madden hit stick, Joey, there's got to be a God level to be this fucking bold to predict pain. Based on his words, buckle the fuck up, because we're going to be living in a higher inflation environment, and that's going to be the reality for quite some time. Somebody even did a detailed analysis of his speech, and it was 1,300 words, only 1,300 words. And in it, Powell mentioned the word price stability. So the words price stability 9 times in 1,300 words. So clearly he's trying to drive home that message that he means business to try to deal with the rising cost that we're experiencing. And the ECB executive board member, Isabel Schnabel, she's a previous winner of the No Coiner of the Week. She was also hinting that higher prices are going to stick around for some time, as these are the new expectations. And gone are the words like transitory and shit, like it's good for us. And man, you know what? Inflation is here. It's going to be staying. Just deal with it. And there's even talk that they're going to continue the course, even if there is a recession. And we don't even know what the definition is, but they're still continuing the course. So pain is definitely on the menu moving forward. The IMF is also predicting that U.S. inflation is going to stick around for 1 to 2 years. And if I read between the lines here, they have no fucking idea what the hell's going to happen moving forward. And even our buddy, Augustin Karstens, he's from the BIS. He was mentioning that advanced economies are overusing monetary policies. No fucking shit. All roads lead to inflation. The 2% targets, Joey, they're probably gone. In fact, from BlackRock, we believe the central banks will ultimately live with inflation. So what is the new target? 4%, 6%, 10%? Who the fuck knows? And there's going to be, there has been so far a lot of comparison with the path forward. From what we should be doing, comparing what happened in the late 70s and early 80s. But ultimately, there's a difference in the fundamentals. The debt to GDP ratio is much, much different this time around. In fact, it's 3 times higher than it is back in those times. And it's debatable what is the most effective path forward to deal with the rising cost. And if they're going to be doing aggressive rate hikes, yeah, okay. But that creates a problem where now you have the total U.S. debt, which is now sitting a little bit north of $30 trillion, very close to $31 trillion, in fact, last I checked today. It's going to be more difficult to service. And this applies not just to governments who have the tools at their disposal to make up any shortcomings, but also individuals and businesses who don't have the same advantage. And with the debt total now, as I mentioned, around $30 trillion, the annual government revenue now sitting at $4 trillion, that's a small number, 4 million versus 30 trillion. So you can understand what's going on here. It's a hard number for them to deal with. And again, if you look at how much it's going to cost to service the debt, if rates keep going up, it could be $1 trillion annually just to service the debt. That's 1/4 of all the government revenue just for servicing a fucking debt. Best way to deal with it, maybe inflate it away. I don't know. It could then be manageable at that point. But if you do it, who loses? In my opinion, if somebody has accumulated a debt that's manageable, they come out a winner. I'm talking about businesses and individuals because you're borrowing at today's dollar and you're going to be paying back at tomorrow's inflated dollar rate. But I think this whole Jackson Hole thing, it just confirms to me they don't have an idea what the fuck they're doing. They don't give a shit what's going to happen. And just buckle up because it's going to be a lot of high inflation moving forward for the next little while. It's stuck with us, unfortunately.
That BlackRock report is interesting. Greg Foss shared that with a friend of this show who was very, very kind to send that to us this morning, which I gave a quick read to.
No, not Greg Foss.
Greg Foss was sharing it as well. He was talking about it as well. Actually, it was a few people on Bitcoin Twitter talking about that report. I would guess people who have, you know, jobs that require that kind of information disseminated, get something like that. And I'm, you know, always interested in hearing what BlackRock has to say. They are a manifester of destiny, of their own destiny, not quite a reactionary firm. So interesting stuff. The Jackson Hole speech, short and to the point, like you mentioned, 1300 words. I think he spoke for something between like 7 and 8 minutes, if I have that right. I look at that, Len, and I think that's a guy who cares about his legacy all of a sudden. And is not really interested in playing politics anymore, is not really interested in hearing what Joe Biden and Corinne Jean-Pierre and Kamala Harris have to say about monetary response. I don't think he much cares for Elizabeth Warren's commentary that he's sending the economy into recession, although again, we're not really sure what that means these days. A couple of things he said, and you mentioned one of them, I'll just mention it one more time. These are quotes, sustained period of lower trend growth. Okay, interesting. More pain for homes and businesses. Ah, very nice. He mentioned Volcker by name. Did you like, that's big. So he's obviously paying attention to what the comparisons are between him and Paul Volcker in the 80s. And I think that means a lot to him. Now here's a bombshell, CBP debut here, CBP news, breaking news. I think they're going to keep raising. I do. I think that they're going to keep raising until inflation is down under 5%, let's say, or under 4%. The 2-year, which we talked about on this program before as an indicator, a leading indicator of where inflation is going. If you're on Twitter or if you're on this stream right now or listening on audio, I'm not going to pull it up because my internet's so fragile, more fragile than the American economy. But pull up the 2-year and look at the weekly candle for the last couple of weeks. The thing is on an absolute tear. It is soaring in anticipation of more rate hikes. And if you look a little further back, when us on this program and others were talking about how the pivot is coming, the pivot is inevitable, you know, that those times, at least in that predictive tool, have changed. So I don't know what he's going to raise to. I don't know what the terminal or what the neutral Fed funds rate is, but we're going to find out, Len. And to your point about, and I'm glad you mentioned this, this sort of debt wall. The thing is that they have to keep raising rates, but the problem is that oil is supposed to react to that as part of broader demand destruction. You know what oil's up in the last 2 days or last 2 weeks?
It's 2 weeks. Across 105, isn't it? Like 15% has been up.
13%. 13%. Yeah. Well, did you see what happened in Iraq? Yeah. I know. Disaster.
So probably. Just for people wondering, there's some sort of civil something going on over there. The U.S. embassy was evacuated. There's gunshots being heard on the streets of Baghdad. I don't know what's going on, but this is obviously going to have an impact with the price of oil moving forward.
Yes, man. And so you have that problem. The issue is that you can't keep raising to try and keep the price of oil down because you're going to hit this debt wall. Federal debt, retail debt, home debt. Like you're so close already to making this basically untenable. You mentioned already, Len, this huge number of people who can't pay their hydro bills in the States. Like when your mortgage rate jumps and you have to pay another $200 a month to live in your house, you're going to have problems. And this scenario is it's unprecedented to have rate hikes at this speed for this long, all while you're draining the strategic petroleum reserve to fucking zero by the time they're done, probably in November. And all while you're printing like crazy, sending stuff out to other countries, you know, Ukraine, for example. And, you know, Len, this is a situation that is not going to end well. For people who still think there's going to be a soft landing, like I don't think anyone who listens to this show thinks that. Obviously, if you're a Bitcoiner, part of the Bitcoin thesis is that the soft landing is basically impossible at this point, and future soft landings are also impossible. There's going to be no softness in the landing for anything from here on out. If you still think it's going to be a soft landing, I like maybe we should start an episode or a separate feed about people who think there's still going to be a soft landing, because I don't know what that thesis looks like anymore. I have no idea. You're seeing basically an energy-fueled collapse, no pun intended, in Europe. It's creeping over to the United States now in a number of different ways. And you're seeing the dollar rip while other currencies are being destroyed, and the dollar is also being destroyed. Like all this stuff together looks terrible for the short and medium term. Longer term, I don't know. We're going to get a debt jubilee or something. Brent Johnson was on Macro Voices last week. Very smart guy. He is basically saying that this great reset thing is whatever. Who knows? Like the terminology, build back better, all that nonsense. I don't know what the conspiracy theory is there exactly, but he is saying that whether you think this is a coordinated effort there or not, there's going to be a debt jubilee, a broad, worldwide, first world, all over the planet, debt jubilee for governments, for people, for everyone. And I just think, like, to your point about responsible debt, if that's in the cards, and it's not just Joey and Len in the basement saying that, it's guys who are worth a couple hundred million who have a lot of experience and a lot of big wins under their belt saying that too. Maybe that's, you know, maybe it is the time to grab some money off this, you know, sinking ship and take your shot, right? Take your chance. I don't know. What do you think?
I think we're in for a bumpy ride moving forward. I don't want to predict if the rates are going to be moving up or moving down. Debt jubilee, who knows? Maybe. As to what degree, how much it's going to be, I have no idea. It's going to be a lot of coordination from a lot of different folks from different countries to actually coordinate such an effort, because this isn't just something that is something in North America. This debt is global wide. They got treasuries, bonds that are owned by so many different foreign actors that how are you going to get them to sign off on this and say, yeah, we're going to go ahead with it. And after it's done, what sort of confidence do you have moving forward with selling any more of these treasuries or bonds? Because at that point, you basically capitulated and said, oh, we fucked up. We're just going to reset the clock right now and try to start from scratch again. It's not lending confidence to the market, and it's going to be bad. Who knows? They may just continually raise rate until something breaks and then figure it out.
It's already breaking is I think the point here. Like oil is not dropping in price. Through all the other mechanisms that would normally help oil to drop in price, demand destruction, all this stuff, it's not dropping. You get temporary relief. If you look at volume on some of these oil stocks, all this stuff is getting bought up on dips. And here we are today after 2 weeks of high positivity price moves in that market. I don't know. Like, what's the plan to keep it down? If this stuff isn't doing it, what other stuff do they have to do?
I don't know. But what I could say is, if you're going to a movie to watch the theaters to watch a movie, right now we're looking at the commercials because wintertime is going to be the main event.
Yeah.
What happens in wintertime, especially with Europe, that's going to be the driving factor of how we're going to come out of this. It's what they're going to be doing to try to rectify this. It's going to be a fucking disaster, especially if it's a cold winter. I don't know how it's going to we're not going to feel the effects over here. It's going to be a fucking zoo, man. How much is, like, look at the energy price. It's in Germany. It's an incredible jump. How much has gone up? Now, 13% of their GDP is going to be dedicated just to buying energy. That's an insane amount. Previously, it was 1%. How can you sustain this? And it's not like it's going to stop at 13%. Maybe in a couple of months, it's going to be 15%, 17%, then 20%. How could you sustain that? Just for buying energy because of stupid policies. I don't know.
there's nothing else to say, right? Like, we see this. I'm looking through Doomberg's Twitter here. Go check out a tweet from about 6 hours ago. I'm not going to bring it up on the screen, but it shows you the swing in energy prices. It's, you know, it's up 2,000. It's up 2,000 euros, and it's down 300 euros. Up another 300. Down. It's the swings are insane. Yeah. I just put out the tweet for the contest, by the way. 8:15 is the day the time it closes tonight. So stick your stuff up there. And when it closes, come back here or stay here. You really should stay here. I don't know why you would leave, but we'll draw the winner. Len, what's the next story, buddy?
Let's go to Canadian stuff. We've a few stories. We'll just chop off this thing. I'm not sure if anybody's been following the Bank of Canada's Twitter account, but the person over there is an epic.
Wait a minute. Do you follow the Bank of Canada's Twitter account?
I do. Have you?
No.
You should. Because
only the ones I see that make it like viral. I look at those, but the regular ones.
The last two. They've only tweeted two of them, and they're viral, the previous two. It's not like there's a lot of fluff in between. They are epic in terms of their trolling ability. Got to give them kudos. Now, the last one I'm just going to read here because in case people haven't seen it. So they were tweeting out, if we printed cash to finance the federal government, we didn't. Keep reading to learn how we supported the economy from shock of the pandemic. The pandemic has been a crisis like no other. As a result, we took various measures like buying up bonds to support and ensure a strong and stable economy. Now, all in all, I don't want to go through the whole thing. They're basically saying they did not print money to pay for bonds. I don't know. For the way I see it is the government of Canada, their debt inflated. They sold bonds to the Bank of Canada, who ultimately purchased them. They sent cash to the Canadian government. Eventually, those bonds, they're going to have to expire. And fine, you can make the case that they didn't print money and inject it in the economy, but a brief period of time they did. But not only that, now there's a huge IOU from the federal government. Their debt went from $700 billion in 2020 to over $1 trillion in 2022. This is all due to their relationship to the Bank of Canada. The Bank of Canada, their Twitter account, truly, I don't have a no-coiner, but this is the one that it's a no-coiner worthy candidate. Troll-worthy, they are 10 out of 10. In terms of actually providing good information, 0 out of 10. So I give them credit on one side, but on the other side, man, they're fucking wrong. They're gaslighting us hard.
It's all semantics, isn't it? This is we've talked about this before, this lack of accessibility to the terminology and the methodology used by central banks and you know, traditional finance more broadly to keep the ship afloat, right? You know, it's scooping out a cup of water out of the sinking ship at a time. And I look at that set of tweets that I just had on my screen, and you're right. It's really something, isn't it? This idea that we didn't print money, we bought bonds. Okay, well, what did you buy the bonds with? Like, well, what did you buy them with? Oh, well, we financed them. We took on debt. Okay, well, who's going to pay for that eventually? Well, if the answer is no one, then okay. But if the answer is no one, you've opened another can of worms. The answer truly is the taxpayer. You're going to have to, according to the Parliamentary Budget Office, by 2041 or 42,
it's going to be all done. But it's an IOU.
Yeah, Len.
What we have is an IOU.
We're gonna get the last bit of data from these last year's treatments of dubious utility at the same time that the federal government balances the budget in 20 years. It's just like this is like a, it's like a Mad TV skit. You know what I mean? Like I can picture like the guy who plays Stewart on Mad TV. I can't remember his name. It might be Mike McDonald or something like that.
Talking
as, you know, acting as Tiff Macklem on a TV show, talking about, no, we didn't buy the bonds. Well, who did? Well, it was, you know, we kind of did, but not really. Like this is for people who don't think critically about any of this stuff. Don't care to go to like, you know, Wikipedia or a podcast or whatever and see exactly what the mechanism is behind the way this stuff works. And honestly, like you will find that once you know how busted this kind of stuff is and how illegitimate this kind of stuff is, you really are going to think about why you keep all your money in cash or adjacent markets adjacent to this kind of behavior, and why you don't have a little bit in something like Bitcoin, honestly. And I think that if you start to look at these things, you know, much like you and I, Len, once you start looking at these things, you cannot unsee all the issues.
$300 billion was tacked on to the Government of Canada debt in 2 years. That's all I have to say. But moving on, the federal government, in fact, some good news from them, they posted a $10.2 billion surplus for the first quarter of this year. And this is quite a huge difference from last year. So the same period of time last year, they had a $36.5 billion deficit. April, May, and June was the first quarter that, and all 3 months are showing up a surplus, and albeit small in each of them. But yeah, that I guess there's some positivity here. But just want to note that this federal deficit last year from 2020 to 2021, so I think it's 2 years ago, that was $327 billion in total. So the $10.2 billion, it's just a drop in the bucket, but I know it's just for a quarter. So maybe if you do it for 4 quarters, that's $40 billion, but still it's a drop in the bucket versus how much was added to the budget to the debt in 2020/2021. So yeah, we have a surplus for a quarter. I guess we could celebrate that.
Should we? Isn't it all about like short memories with stuff like this? I always think, like even with that story earlier about the $300 billion that's supposed to come in from the Inflation Reduction Act just being given away in student debt relief, I think a lot of this reporting relies heavily on us just saying like, we don't remember what happened a year ago. We don't remember all the talk about the deficit. We don't remember what the PBO said. Just tell us the good news for today and, you know, I'll be on my way. I'll nod my head, shake your hand, and off I go. I think people are starting to have longer memories personally. I don't know if that's just what I'm seeing in my life. Maybe you're seeing it too. Maybe you are as well, listeners and viewers, but I think people are starting to really think about this a little more, unfortunately for our friends in Parliament, because I don't think these stories really land the way that they're intending them to land at this point.
Next story, Joey, I want to give a thanks to Canada Extreme who provided me this one. And it looks like that there's something going on at Canada's largest banks, and they're blocking clients from accessing high yield funds. And advisors from several of these major banks are not able to buy for their clients high interest savings ETFs, such as cash ETFs or HISA ETFs, high interest savings account ETFs. They're now put on the quote unquote restricted lists. And this is usually reserved for risky volatile investments. Imagine if those things are now landing on risky volatile investment lists. And they are saying they offer satisfactory suite of cash products to their clients, making the high interest saving account ETFs unnecessary. You know what? I could go on and on about this.
I can't believe, Len, whose bingo card was that on, man? Whose bingo card was that on?
You know, the funny thing is a lot of those products that are being offered by the banks, they're not as quick to react to changes in the market. So example, the high interest savings account, I think the interest rates right now is 3.5%, give or take, on that ETF, which is not too bad. But it's much higher than like the GICs or whatever you get from the banks. And also it's easily, you could liquidate it much easier rather than waiting for the thing to reach maturity. So it looks like they're just trying to cut the knees off from a lot of these, and especially, you know, I don't know. I don't want to go any further because we have to eventually get a bank account again. So maybe I talk favorably of them right now. So yeah.
Oh man. Should we make them our no coiner of the week? I hadn't really crossed my mind, but maybe we will at this point. I might even name and shame the guy who signed the letter. But anyway, yeah, okay. Go on to the next story. Sure.
We can't do that just yet. The reason being is we don't have the official reason. Once I get the official reason, then he's officially no coiner of the week.
Okay, got it.
So, story from betterdwelling.com. They have wrote an article showing that Canada's home equity line of credit, the debt, is accelerating much, much faster. And so they noticed in June, the loan balances jumped quite a bit. So the outstanding balances hit $171 billion in total for the month of June. And that's up 0.6% from 1 month prior. That's about $1.1 billion tacked on. Compared that to the previous year, the increase is a whopping 2.9% higher. So it went up quite a bit since the previous year. We're still far from the peak, which was around $200 billion in 2013, but it's still trending in the wrong direction. We talked about it last year. 1 in 4 Canadians are taking on debt in order to pay for some of their fixed costs. I'm wondering if home equity line of credit is one that they're tapping into, given the fact, because it's a secured type of credit, interest rates are really, really low. But you can only go to this well so often before something happens. You either got to pay it back or sell the house to pay everything back. Scary stuff.
It's just another example of the economy not being as strong as everyone says. Here's the thing, okay? We talk a lot on this show about the dire straits that people who don't own homes may find themselves in if they want to purchase a home in the next year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, whatever. I think those are justifiable comments. But one thing we don't, I think, talk enough about, and we talk about it a lot, but one thing we don't talk enough about is how HELOCs are really a sign that even those among us who are quote unquote well-to-do, and I don't think I'm well-to-do. I don't think you're well-to-do. I think we're doing all right. You know what I mean? Like
others, I'm very blessed. I have a house.
Exactly. But I don't think you and me are not, taking trips to Cabo every two months or three times a winter. You know what I mean? I think that there's a lot of people with homes who, I don't know how to phrase this. There's a lot of people with homes who think that they should live a certain lifestyle, I think. I see this sometimes with my neighbors. I see it sometimes with acquaintances of mine, not really my friends, but acquaintances of mine. And I think that most of the living is being done through vehicles like the HELOC. I think that there used to be a time, maybe pre-COVID, where taking money off your HELOC was feasible. If you want to take a vacation, you could take $3,000 off your HELOC, $4,000 off your HELOC and pay it back in a reasonable amount of time because other expenses in your life weren't constantly creeping and pinching. But now, Len, people are not willing, I don't think, to give up that sort of standard of living, certainly not after being forced inside for 18 months or 24 months, whatever the number is you pick. And instead of changing that lifestyle, what they're going to find is the expenses that didn't used to give them any trouble are now giving them trouble. And so you're going to see those HELOC numbers and then creep up and up and up and up. I want to know in the winter what that HELOC number looks like. Because to your point about energy costs and about cold winters, specifically here in Canada, I think those things are going to come home to roost a little bit. So let's keep an eye on this one. We talked about it before, like you mentioned, talked about it tonight. And I'm sure we'll talk about it in the meantime. But in December, January, February, let's see where those numbers are.
Financial Post. They're reporting that rent has shot up in Toronto, and this is now impacting students. And some are starting to take advantage of homeless shelters. In 2019, 26% of residents of the Covenant House of Toronto, the shelter where Aston works, this guy named Aston was interviewed in this thing, were students. 26% of the people there were students, which is an incredible number. And that was 2019. Since then, things have changed quite a bit. I can imagine that this number is now going to go much higher. Maybe a third of the people are living there. I don't know. But this is a sad thing where you have now students that are coming here that are taking advantage of homeless shelters as a way to make ends meet. This is absolutely pathetic for a country like Canada that touts itself to be charitable and have all these resources available to us. When students for these schools, granted, it's expensive to go to these schools, but fuck, man, homeless shelters? How fucking pathetic is that, man? That's sick.
I know. And don't forget, university tuition is creeping higher every single year, fueled by government subsidy and other programs that, again, same as our neighbors to the south, remove the economic calculation for both the institution and the student. And it's going to continue until there's you know, a breaking point. What's the breaking point? I don't know. Is it homeless shelters overflow with students? Is it students sleeping on the street? Is it students, you know,
to give you an idea,
students disrupting the current state of affairs in residence or dorm systems? I have no idea. But anyway, yeah, go ahead. Give me an idea.
So before the pandemic, the average stay was 3 months. Now it's closer from 6 months to a year, and demand keeps rising. Yeah. So not only is the stays longer, but that also takes out of the equation a bed that may be used once they leave. So it creates a spiral effect. And where are people going to go? I don't know, man. Are students going to go to soup kitchens next to try to fill their belly with something? It's really sad what this is transpiring here. And What happens when these students ultimately graduate? What type of experience do they get? And where's going to be their political ideology? Will it be something? I don't want to guess. I don't want to even talk about it too much, but it's going to skew their ideas.
You know what it'll be. And I didn't want to say this earlier, but like this is the reason these post-secondary institutions don't want to change the status quo, because it's clear. Okay. I won't say it either, but it's clear to you and to me and to everyone listening, I would guess, which political stripe these kids are going to come out wearing. And I don't think there's any, like, there's not an honest argument against that at this stage. And I think people have to stop with this, you know, blind partisanship. And you could accuse me of that too, or accuse you of that too, maybe from the other side. But I think on this particular point, the damage is like, it's so obvious and so widespread. And it's like this parasite in everything. It's in coffee shops, right? For different corporations like Starbucks. It's in boardrooms. It's in, you name it. Like, I don't want to get banned from YouTube or worse, but like, just start thinking about this stuff, listener, viewer. It's very clear that we got to do something about all this in the not too distant future.
Agreed. And let's move on. We'll talk about the Canada mortgage debt. Again, this is another story from betterdwelling.com. And it's noted here that it's rising at a pace of $500 million per day on average. This is a total debt in Canada for mortgages. And although the Canada mortgage debt is slowing down slightly, but it's not really slowing down fast enough. The outstanding balance has reached $2 trillion in June, and that's up $18 billion from a month earlier. And if you're going to look back from the same month last year, it's up 9.7% from there. And so that's basically, if you do the math, it's averaging $500 million per day that's being tacked onto the total Canadian mortgage debt every day. And it's going to probably continue like that for the next little while. Again, and as rates go up and it's getting harder to service this debt, this is something that's going to pop. Like, eventually, once it does, it's going to be disastrous. And yeah, and it's more evidence that things are just coming to the end, and it's just, be prepared for it.
So that's your HELOC stat, right? Mortgage debt and HELOCs. Your HELOC is part of your mortgage payment. So if that's the number, then $500 million a day, that's the number?
$500 million a day, yeah.
Like, what are we doing, man? Where are these people politically involved or otherwise, who think the economy is healthy? How can you possibly say that when the most wealthy people in your society, homeowners with equity on their home, are raising their debt load by $1 billion every 2 days? How can you possibly say the economy is healthy?
The only way, honestly, you have to be a Fiat apologist to come up to that conclusion, is nobody with two brain cells in their head that they could rub them together are going to come to a conclusion anything else that besides that it's going to collapse. So you really got to be tied to at the hip to the existing system, and you don't want it to collapse, and you wanted to see it go on because you're benefiting from it. Those are the people that are the ones that are saying, yeah, things are great and it's going to remain great moving forward. The reality is not the case. It's far from it.
Far from it. That's unbelievable. That's a great stat. We got this week, I should mention, we have Ritesh Jain, CEO of Pine Tree Macro. He's very focused on Canadian economy, housing, things like that. We shared a couple of his charts a few weeks ago. He's going to be on Wednesday night to talk to us about what's going on in this country. I get the feeling that you're going to want to tune in for this. He's a lesser known name than some of the other guests we've had, but if you look at his Twitter feed, the man is sharp. I'm really looking forward to talking to him.
the housing market is a good indicator of what's going on with the economy. So having him come on and talk about this in great detail, it's going to be an educating experience. So yeah, definitely tune in for that. And the last story I have in a Canadian block is about our sponsor, one of our sponsors, Ledin. And they have just announced today that their rates for the month of September will remain unchanged. So if you have Bitcoin on their network, so balances up to 0.1 BTC will be earning 5.25% APY, and balances beyond 0.1 BTC will earn 2.0 APY. And USDC, it's going to be 7.5% APY on all USDC, regardless of the amount you have on their network. So yeah, just giving this news, it's hot off the press. It just came off just, I guess, an hour or two ago. And I hope some people are using this, because I use it and it's a good way to stack more sats.
You should use our promo code to sign up for this. Okay. This is not a paid ad read. We actually use the service. We talk about these rates, whether they sponsor the show or not. I use it. Len uses it. It's not a bad place to park a little coin. You know what I'm very happy about, Len? That through all of this, even though we talk a lot of shit about BlockFi, you know who never talks any shit about BlockFi? Ledin. They never stoop to that level that you and I stoop to frequently or semi-frequently. And that says something about the quality of people they got over there. So yeah, I'm happy to hear the rates are staying unchanged. Good sign.
Well, they were one of the potential purchasers of the BlockFi at one
time. Yeah, right? they were mentioned, yeah.
Yeah, so I could see them not really talking shit about them, especially if they're thinking of purchasing them. But yeah, that's it for the Canadian side. I do have one story on the rest of the news I'm going to bring up, because we're getting close to the 8:15 marker. So China, they imported about $108 million worth of Russian gold in July. And this is a 750% increase from June. And it's a 4,800% increase from the same month last year. Some countries, they're stacking a lot of gold moving forward. So just read between the lines. Something is happening. People want to get this asset on their balance sheet. It's a, you know what, U.S. dollar dominance, it's coming to an end. It's although it's going up in comparison to its peers, maybe not against the ruble, but against the other Western nation or Western friendly nations, it's doing well. But again, it's in a basket of shit coins. So it's if Doge is doing well in comparison to Sheep, great. But you know what, it's meaningless to me.
I'm interested in getting a guest on that I've had in mind now for probably a couple of weeks to talk to us about BRICS and how de-dollarization is really going to take shape in the next 5 to 10 years, if not sooner. And I'm not going to name the man, because if we do get him, I want it to be a bit of a surprise. But I think that it'd be worth talking to someone who really understands this, because you and me talk a little bit most weeks about one of those countries, whether it's vis-a-vis energy or gold or Belt and Road related initiatives, stuff like that. This stuff is important. And we, as much research as we do, as much listening to stuff as we do, we're not really equipped to give an in-depth 30, 40 minute talk on it, but there is a guy I know who is, and I think it might be worth getting someone like that on. If you're listening, watching, let us know somewhere. I don't know, comments or on Twitter if you're interested in something like that. But if you are, I think there's a guy we could reach out to.
Agreed. Yeah, that sounds good. And that's it for the rest of the news. I don't have a Bitcoin or a no coiner of the week. I guess my pseudo choice would be the Bank of Canada, whoever's running that Twitter feed. But you know what? I can't really make them, because they're just so good at trolling us. So I got to give them kudos for that. And I don't want to make them the no coiner just based off that. But if you have one, we could talk about tahinis and just roll right there.
I got nothing this week, man. I wish I did. I've been so busy the last few days. So I didn't dig through Twitter to find someone to, deliver the fire to this evening. But that's okay, Lens. We don't always have it, but we're still happy to direct people to tahini's restaurants. They're a great place to get a shawarma and a bowl, right? Always a bowl, yeah. Market, as we like to say.
Some 15 locations, if I recall correctly, in Southern Ontario. So if you live within Southern Ontario and you're obviously going to be within driving distance of one or several tahini's, check them out, man. Ali's a great guy, great Bitcoiner, and you're going to have a heck of a time going there. In fact, I went to tahini's a little while ago with one of the people in the chat right now. Don't want to say who it is in case he doesn't want to be called out, but he was very happy to go, and he had goosebumps when he started eating one of the shawarmas over there, because it was so fucking tasty. So yeah, I can't say good enough about Tahini's and Ali as well. So there we go. Joey, that's it for the show. Do you want to just close this one up and then go right to the after show and do the giveaway?
Yeah, let's okay. do it. I'm happy to do that. I'm exhausted. I'm glad you said that. Anything you want to say before we go or what? Just the price?
Yeah. What else can I say aside from thank you very much for all the people in chat that have been here for it? It's been a rocking chat, number one. Number two, again, keep donating sats through Fountain or through Podcasting 2.0 or Value for Value, whatever you want to call it. They're all going to Bitcoin Akasi. They're all being directed right to them. So it's a good cause. If you send us sats, we're not taking it. We're just donating it to somewhere else to hopefully it will be used for bigger and better purposes than just sitting in minor Joey's pockets.
Exactly. The price of Bitcoin, Len, $20,250 US.
And I got in Canadian dollars is $26,322.
Love it. Okay. Great. Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll see you Wednesday night with Ritesh Jain. We're going to talk a lot of Canadian economy, a lot of Canadian real estate. You're going to love it. Take care of yourselves till then.
Namaste.